Escape Pod 40. February 9th, 2006. Today's story, Even Vatsothos, by Bruce Holland Rogers.
Hello, I'm Steve Ely, and once again, welcome to Escape Pod. There was an interesting piece in the news this week that caught my eye. Stop me if you've heard this, or fast forward. It's been widely reported for years that scientists working for a number of U.S. federal agencies have been, shall we say, encouraged to be selective in how they release some data, and been given a little help in what conclusions to draw from that data. The latest scandal came from NASA, when the New York Times reported that their top climate scientist had been threatened and blockaded from the press by a 24-year-old public relations weasel appointed by the White House. This same weasel had also been calling to add the word theory to every mention of the Big Bang, since he felt that it didn't take into account intelligent design. The unusual part of this story is that it has a happy ending. NASA's administrator issued a strong agency-wide declaration that, quote, "It is not the job of public affairs officers to alter, filter, or adjust engineering or scientific material produced by NASA's technical staff." And the weasel in question got the boot after it turned out that he'd lied about a few technical details, such as graduating college. So this is a win for science. Add to that the Dover decision last month, and things don't look quite as bad for people who hold the wacky religious belief that making observations about the world is a good way to explain it. Now, before you send me irate emails about going into politics again, I want to make clear that I don't view this as a political issue. Stupidity transcends party lines. It's not the current administration that once introduced and passed a bill in Indiana legislating the value of pi to 3. What matters isn't that everyone agree about public policy or religious doctrine or even the conclusions made by these scientists. What matters is respect for the principle of observation. That's what science is. You observe the world, and you explain those observations. That makes it a moving target, but if you ignore or suppress the observations, you're sticking your fingers in your ears and going, la 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 la, and sooner or later, the world hits you on the head. This happens way too often. It has happened way too often throughout history. And that's why the presence of reason in some of our important offices is something to celebrate. Today's story is not so celebratory, but rather cautionary. To go back to the axis I once mentioned, we present Even Vatsothos by Bruce Holland Rogers. Bruce is a very diverse writer and speaker who lives in Eugene, Oregon, but when you look at the workshops he's running in Italy and Crete and all the world traveling he's done, you have to wonder when he's there. He won the World Fantasy Award in 2004 for his story Don Isidro, which also appeared in Escape Pod, and he has a very cool subscription service that emails you dozens of short stories a year for just $5. I'm a very happy subscriber to it. You can go to shortshortshort.com and ask him for a free trial. Today's story first appeared this month on the website scifidimensions.com. They've been a leading science fiction news site for many years, and Bruce's story is inaugurating their new original fiction section. A new fiction market is a very happy thing. So go by and check them out. And finally, I want to give thanks to Dag Vigo Lokoin for going out of his way to help me with some of the Norwegian names in this story. Any mangled pronunciation is strictly my fault. He did his best. So put on your warm coat and your woolly mittens. It's story time. Even Vatsothos by Bruce Holland Rogers. Enlightened justice can be cold. I am serving the first phase of my sentence at the Bergen Prison and Cryogenic Center, Osterøy Division. As prisons go, it's almost cozy. A long time ago, this campus was a school. Then, late in the last century, it was made into a minimum security facility. There are no bars anywhere. I may have as many blankets as I want. I sleep in a private room equipped with a wooden chair and an antique writing desk. I am encouraged to write my thoughts and feelings. I am free to roam the grounds, which are maintained by professional gardeners now that there isn't sufficient prison labor to do the job. I can walk right to the water's edge and look across at the forested slopes of the Norwegian mainland. But that's as far as I can go. If I stepped into the water, my transponder would alert the guards. They would rush to prevent my suicide. That's what they'd think, that I was trying to drown myself. The water is cold for swimming. The prison governor herself summons me for a visit in her office every week. She always asks if I have any complaints about how I am being treated, as if I were a tourist here on Osnesoy Island. I am cold all the time, but that's hardly worth mentioning. Instead, I tell her, I'm going to die. You people have sentenced me to death. There is no death penalty here, she says.
There is for me.
At my next therapy session, the therapist asks if I am contemplating suicide.
Did the governor tell you that?
She doesn't understand. You don't understand. My sentence is a death sentence, even if that isn't what the court had in mind.
You won't die, he says.
But a lot will probably have changed by the time you're resuscitated. People you know may have died in the interim. The world will have changed. Change can be dramatic. It's understandable.
I glare at him. You don't get it. You don't understand the first thing about my crimes.
Then I hug myself for warmth. He keeps his office too cold.
So explain it to me, he says.
I do. I explain it all. When I have finished, he tells me that he's not worried. He's not worried. Well, he's not going to be frozen, is he? I try to tell the physician who regularly checks my health and tests my reaction to small samples of the chemicals they will use.
You're killing me, I say.
You're in good health.
I will die.
We have never botched a resuscitation, he says.
You'll be fine.
Then he tells me to hold still for a subcutaneous injection of a microcrystallizing agent.
We want to make sure you aren't allergic. This may sting a little.
I am running out of time. My procedure is tomorrow. They will freeze me solid and then move me to a storage facility in Vatsa. Even Vatsa thaws in the summer. The only person who might understand is Spoonheim, the corrections sociologist. He just arrived. It's his job to understand me thoroughly and to write a report that his successors will use to decide if it's safe to revive me. His report will help them decide if I am no longer a threat to society because society has changed enough to deal with me or has learned to treat behaviors like mine.
I am already remorseful, I tell him at our first interview. I won't do it again.
We are sitting at a table by the water. A light mist falls.
I shouldn't have done it. I shouldn't have even thought about it. Once I was one of the people fighting to preserve the last wild polar bears. I wanted to protect the Earth.
I get myself worked up. I am close to tears.
Spoonheim checks the screen on his handheld.
Your sentence calls for a review of your case every 10 years. 10 years isn't that long.
I'll die. You don't understand.
Make me understand, he says. Start at the beginning.
The beginning. The very beginning? That would start with growing up on the western edge of Boulder, Colorado, right against the foothills. Our street dead-ended at the trailhead for a mountain park. Deer visited our yard so often that my mother gave up on trying to have a garden. I saw a bear once from my bedroom window. My father and I hiked the trails together until I was old enough to go out alone. When fresh snow fell, my footprints were usually the first ones on the trail. Or maybe the beginning came when I knew that the mountains of Colorado weren't quite paradise. Some of the deer suffered a wasting disease that no one could explain. Every summer, more and more bears came into town because drier winters made for poor foraging in the mountains. The authorities tagged the bears and relocated them, but since there still wasn't sufficient food in the back country, the bears would find their way back into town, to be shot dead. Before I was out of high school, I understood that the Earth was in trouble. I carried signs. I unfurled banners. At 20, I dropped out of college to live on handouts and protest full-time. What was the point of studying molecules when whole species were going extinct? With like-minded people, I traveled to Churchill, Manitoba, to bring attention to the late arrival of the snowpack. But we were too late. Canadian wildlife officials had already captured the remaining bears so they wouldn't starve. Signs and banners weren't enough. I started to spike trees, set fire to new construction, and destroy machinery.
As I understand it, Spoonheim says, when you hide a spike in a tree, you endanger the lives of sawmill operators. Yes? Is this appropriate?
I look at him. He is half smiling in a friendly way, encouraging me to keep talking.
So what? I said.
What do you mean?
Why should people be more important than any other species?
I don't try to hide my anger.
You asked me to start at the beginning. Maybe that's it. The real beginning is when I started to hate people. It wasn't a great jump from loving the Earth to hating people. Before I had dropped out of college, I learned that every so often, a super disruptive species evolves. A super predator, say, that is so successful that it hunts out the very populations it depends on. It feeds itself to death. Aren't we like that, we human beings? We are everywhere, crowding out other species except for those that are like us, from our songbird-eating cats to Caulerpa taxifolia.
Caulerpa, says Spoonheim.
A macroalgae, I tell him. An aquarium plant that was accidentally released into the Mediterranean. Like human beings, it is too successful. It crowds out everything else. Diverse marine meadows become deserts of Caulerpa.
Ah, yes. I have heard of it.
You should have. It'll wipe out the last commercial fishing in the Mediterranean in 5 years. Maybe sooner. What I hated was our arrogance, as if it didn't matter what we did. When rich people started freezing themselves when they got sick, taking up space and energy to stay around until they could be cured, I couldn't stand it anymore. Humanity was headed for a cliff. One day we'd look down, expecting to see the web of life that had always sustained us, and there would be almost nothing there. A biosphere that could support 10 billion of us would be gone. What was left might feed 10 millions. 10 million very sorry people. And if that was where we were headed anyway, why not speed things up? Why fight it? In fact, why not hasten the end so that I could see people coming to realize what they had done? Little by little, I began to formulate a plan. Little by little, I began to find the companions who were as frustrated as I was, who were as sick of fighting human nature.
Did you consider, Spoonheim says, the fate of the people who would starve?
I don't answer. I look out across the water. The truth is, I used to have fantasies about families and big houses with nice furniture fighting to the death for a crust of bread. Spread and consume. Spread and consume. See where it gets you. When I continue my silence, he says,
did you expect that you would survive?
Again, I don't want to say. We did lay in supplies. We planned to live long enough at least to gloat. Perhaps we would even endure the whole crisis and emerge as the people who had seed a new race that scratched out a bare subsistence and lived in fearful awe of the Earth.
What exactly did you do?
It's in the trial transcripts.
Yes, Spoonheim agrees. But I want to hear it from you.
We did our work in greenhouses, hidden deep in the Norwegian forest. The plants we grew were all species that were already creating ecological havoc somewhere. Caulerpa taxifolia in the Mediterranean Sea, knapweed on the rangelands of North America, Japanese knotweed along European rivers. Dangerous exotics. We made them more dangerous. We bred kudzu that could survive harder frosts. We made knapweed poisonous to the insects that were used to control its spread. Our Caulerpa could grow in waters as cold as the North Sea. Once our plants were well established, vast expanses of rangeland would become useless for grazing, poisonous for horses, and too bitter for cattle to eat. Fisheries would collapse as Caulerpa overgrew productive seabeds. Waterfowl would starve while foraging in wetlands choked with purple loosestrife. Spoonheim says,
I don't doubt that you would have caused trouble, you and your compatriots, by releasing those plants.
Nothing less than total economic collapse, I tell him. When it happens, it will make the Great Depression look like a walk in the park.
Ah, but your operation was raided. You were shut down. Your plants, your greenhouses and aquariums were all destroyed.
Everything physical, yes. You're right. That was all destroyed. But our ideas, I look him in the eye, our ideas are out. They're everywhere. Spoonheim frowns.
I see. But it takes someone to implement them.
Do you think I'm so rare? Or my anger? Do you think my anger is unique?
Not unique among your fellow conspirators, he says, but in the general population.
Let me tell you, I had little trouble finding such people. There are others. Perhaps they are already at work. Some of them will be smarter than I am, better than I was at making invasive plants worse. Spoonheim looks skeptical. Suppose, then, that no one does take up our cause. All right. Then the disaster will take 50 years, not 10 or 12. It will still come, don't you see? And if I'm still frozen, When the fishing boats return with a 20th of their catch, when farm yields drop and hunters nearly always come home with empty hands, how long do you think Norway will continue to keep electricity and the power grid? How long do you think you'll keep me safely frozen? If civilization as we know it fails, I will thaw. Not a proper thaw, just a power failure. I will die.
It doesn't seem likely to me. People do want to solve these problems.
You should be able to tell someone how sorry I am. There should be some sort of appeal.
Appeals are strictly limited, Spoonheim says.
Please.
But you see, it's out of my hands, really. We have a justice system that doesn't drag matters out. In the whole scheme of things, the prisoner loses so little by being frozen for 10 years or even 100.
100 years?
Even if your remorse is genuine, society has a right to protect itself.
And if ecological collapse comes in the meantime?
Spoonheim considered me. He turned off his handheld. He looked out over the water, then back at me.
In that case, he said, I will consider you lucky. You won't feel a thing.
And that was our story. I have nothing pithy to add to that. Very briefly, I want to call your attention to one more link on our website, and that's to our review guidelines. We've heard the call for more content every week, and we're ready to answer it. I'm happy to announce that Dr. Jonathan Sullivan, or Silly Dog, has formally joined us as our reviews editor, and he's looking for your take on books, movies, games, anything that's speculative fiction. Just go to our website at escapepod.org and click on Reviews in the top left, underneath our submission guidelines. I've got a couple more call-in book reviews, which I'll play over the next few shows, but in the future we'll be looking for these in-depth reviews exclusively. Escape Pod is released on a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. If you like what you've heard, please tell your friends, and if you can, please consider donating via the PayPal link at our site. Our opening music was, as always, by permission of Daikaiju. Our closing music is by permission of Red Hunter. This song is called The Fall, and it's from his album Alien Sun, which you can buy at his website, redhunter.tv. If you find yourself listening to this song over and over again, you're not the only one. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
A million tents and trailers will cover the open desert. Your kids will learn again how to build a fire, where to look for water, and the families are bound together now by the fall of all the great cities. Finally, to sing out their stories and the histories of hunger and of victories back into the old gypsy circles where the swaying girls will play out the old rituals. The boys will be delirious, but desperate and serious. The chasing will be furious. The drums and the rain are gonna come together howling. The cities are all lost, but the circle is found and tie us together. Ooh, my kind of town. Fall, I was a singer, saw the future laid out in dominoes. Now I hunt the buffaloes. And my darling, who were you behind the counter with the day memorized and those cold vacant eyes? Well, you swore you were free, swore you could see him coming. It was old Angel Midnight staring you down. He's stealing the water right out of the ground. And the news is all true, but the views are unsound. The market is dead and the phone lines are down, but it ties us together. Ooh, my kind of town.